Not really. Upstanding citizens were expected to donate massive amounts of semen toward the effort to reproduce children, the vast majority of which would be exported in order to obtain the homosexuals being retained in Caucasia and Blacktopia. The physical demands of these sperm drives had all but eradicated recreational male sex, and those men who couldn't meet their quota, or whose seed was subpar, they were compelled to donate money toward the fund for ransoming new citizens. The survival of Geisha depended on this effort. Delicious grasped the dismal situation. Her gentry had done his duty thrice today. He was spent. Whereas men in Geisha were compelled to donate, the women weren't without their own responsibilities to ensure the future of the nation. Throughout history, men had been conscripted to perform military service. They'd surrendered their bodies and their lives to the state. In keeping with this precedent, now women were drafted. If selected and suitable, a female citizen of Geisha must agree to insemination. Donated seed would be used to create a new life, and the woman would carry it. All fertile women were eligible, and nothing short of a medical emergency could excuse someone from her maternity service. The resulting children were largely for export, but they would be raised until the age of declaration. Exported or not, each would equate to a new citizen. That was the reason Delicious had shaved her legs, the motivation for her to risk her freedom, to sneak down to this wallow of degradation. Squatting there, she worked gentry with both her hands and her mouth, but to no avail. No matter how badly she wanted to get pregnant, to bear his child, that wasn't going to happen tonight. Resigned, she reached to where she'd set her purse on the foul floor. From it, she retrieved the letter that had arrived this same day. Gentry helped her to her feet, and she handed him the envelope. The government knew she had it. She'd been required to sign for it. In the faint light from the video screen, her husband unfolded the paper and squinted to read it. On the screen, in what was clearly a pre-adjustment day film, two men were happily ejaculating upon each other's smiling faces. Delicious watched this anointment, thinking, "What a waste." Gentry looked at her, his brow furrowed in confusion. "What's this mean?" Delicious tried to sound chipper. "I've been drafted." He cocked his head. "What's that mean? Drafted?" If he didn't understand it, it was because he didn't want to. According to the notice, Delicious was to submit for artificial insemination within 24 hours. After evading the police, after she'd ventured into this sinkhole of depravity, the combination of wine and fear finally hit her. Unless she could coax her husband to love her, she'd soon be carrying a stranger's child. Frantically weeping, she allowed her falling tears to wet her smooth palms, and Delicious redoubled her hopeless effort to arouse her beloved's flaccid member. To the world, they looked like two plastic packets of ketchup from any fast food restaurant. Their temperature gave the only hint of their true nature. That, and each packet, upon closer inspection, proved to be tampered with. One edge of each had been cut open and glued shut, not heat-sealed as the other edges, but glued. The bigger giveaway was that they felt like ice. So cold, Shasta had to squeeze them gently in her fists, squeezing and releasing them until their thick plastic and sharp edges felt pliable. The great reception chambers of Charlie's palace bustled with court life. Silks and taffetas swept the gleaming wood floors, and ruddy jewels flashed in the sunlight from tall windows. Strolling troubadours strummed lutes in an effort to lighten the general mood. The court physician had been summoned, and all waited about in bated conversation. Around Shasta milled the formidable wives of other chieftains, their public wives, adorned in the booty plundered from many a museum or gallery. None among them had any royal training, beyond serving as queen of a homecoming dance or senior prom. They were the prettiest put forward by their settlements. Chieftain Brock had taken as his favorite an impoverished young lady from the ruins of Seattle. Although he owned field wives and household wives aplenty, only Charlie had yet to claim a public wife. A passing footman offered a tray of grilled peacock tongues. Shasta selected one. Slyly, she only pretended to put the delicious tongue between her lips. In truth, she deftly dropped the tongue into her ample cleavage. In its stead, she placed one of the two ketchup packets in her mouth, tucking it secretly within her cheek. As another waiter bowed low to present an assortment of Scotch eggs arrayed in an embossed silver chafing dish, Shasta repeated her sleight of hand, dropping the eggs into her cleavage while hiding the second ketchup packet within her opposite cheek. The aroma of food rose from her bodice, and she struggled to swallow her own saliva. Her mouth must be dry when the testing took place. Her own natural saliva would betray her. If the laboratories at 23andMe were accurate, her spit would prove her to be a 54% sub-Saharan genetic descent, making her ineligible to reside in Caucasia, much less become wife to a chieftain. No. What she held squirreled away in her cheeks was the packaged saliva of an undeniably white girl. They'd hammered out an agreement. If charm would help Shasta succeed in becoming Charlie's public wife, Shasta would use her lofty position to assist charm in some yet-to-be-named endeavor. At the hour appointed for the trial, the great clock struck. The minstrels fell silent and the assembled royals fell to bended knee. A major domo clicked his heels and announced, "The chief surgeon of the realm approaches!" The surgeon was among Charlie's inner circle. Terence, his name was. Some former invalid who'd been rousted from his deathbed by the stirring words of Talbot. He marched from the far end of the gallery, his emerald green tabard blazing, embroiled with thread of gold. Pearls the size of Spanish peanuts studded his codpiece. To guess from their buttery softness, his thigh-high boots could have been fashioned from nothing except the finest of pleather. Whatever his infirmity had been, the surgeon showed no trace of it. A fine cascade of blonde ringlets fell to his shoulders. Before reaching Shasta, he paused in the center of the crowd and lowered his head while he intoned a short prayer. O Odin, father of Thor and Balder. He lifted his voice toward the elaborately coffered and frescoed ceiling. Odin, bearer of the spear of Gunnar and husband of Frigg. Listening, Shasta tried not to think of the tasty peacock tongue that was even now lodged betwixt her lovely breasts, lest she salivate. She held her jaw slack to prevent perforating the ketchup packets and prematurely filling her mouth with priceless white girl spit. O Odin, the surgeon continued, we pray that this woman proves pure enough to serve as our queen. In closing, he plunged the fingers of one expert hand into his sporran. From its depths, he removed something that shined like a halo in the chamber's gloom. It was rumored he possessed fantastic healing power, and that upon reading the words of the Talbot book, he'd thrown himself from his deathbed and pledged his newfound vigor to serving Caucasia. The shining object he presented was a sterile petri dish, and with it he approached Shasta. Silently she pursed her lips and sucked her mouth dry. The Scotch egg she dropped into her bodice slipped lower, and she could feel its warmth against her tensed abs. She must not bite the packets until the ritual began. No formal medical training had Terence, but it was widely known that his palate was so refined that with a single sip of a person's sample he could detect one's entire racial background. He knelt before Shasta, holding out the petri dish like an offering. This was her moment. She bent her face over the empty vessel. Using her back teeth, she gnawed a rent in one packet. The foreign taste of a strange girl's cold drool flooded her tongue. She burst the second packet and the sensation doubled. Her mouth was awash in the foreign tang of Charm's bodily fluids. Cooler than Shasta expected, the fluid squirted between her molars. The slippery wetness of Charm coated Shasta's tongue, so much so that when she bent her face to dribble a dainty sample into the glass dish, a gushing tide of girl saliva fell from her lips. The downpour swamped the edges of the petri dish. Terence, the surgeon, looked up in surprise. His extended arms trembled with the added weight. Shasta blushed furiously. In what she hoped was an elegant gesture, she wiped her dripping mouth with the billowing sleeve of her silk gown. Resist she did the impulse to twist her head aside and spit until the flavor of Charm's salivary glands haunted her taste buds no more. Round-eyed with shock was the noble company in attendance. The surgeon assessed the brimming dish. In a hushed, awed tone, Terence gushed, "M'lady, the hue of your expectorant shows great promise." Whosoever saliva this was, it glistened in his hands. A silver glint highlighted its beauty. The froth of it showed bluish, such was its purity. Shasta said a silent prayer, the spit wasn't hers. The two ruptured packets still rested inside her cheeks. Discreetly, so not to be noticed, she fished the fingers of one hand far down between her breasts and sought out the stashed peacock tongue and the scotch egg. To rid her mouth of Charm's taste, she quickly gulped down both of the rare delicacies. The royal surgeon lifted the sample to his nose. He sniffed at the gooey liquid. He put the brim to his lips, tipped it, and began to sip. He sloshed the sample back and forth between his cheeks. He smacked his lips. Dawson had never rebuilt a woman. Not to date. Like every man, he'd seen women totaled, rolled so bad a woman's frame so twisted she'd never be put back into proper alignment, fit only for the junkyard. He'd seen a fine woman so neglected that finally her chassis had rusted through. And he'd seen older women given the hot rod treatment, layered with Bondo to smooth their curves, tricked out with hooker headers and repainted in colors that were barely street legal. He inspected the gal he'd found on the road. Tuckered out as she was, she'd fallen asleep in the cab of his rig, leaned against the side door. Little more than a pile of dirty laundry. A gal with her upbringing. She figured that history only moved in one direction. The Talbot book had proved her wrong. With a price on her head, she was a dead PhD walking. The two-lane highway skirted fields that stretched to the horizon, as many rows of eggplants as there were ripples in the ocean. Tended by a platoon of stooped women with headscarves knotted to cover their hair. Refugees from the cities. The cities weren't sustainable. Never mind all the recycling and the wind turbine power. Cities were never sustainable. They'd collapsed into the pits of cannibalism, with the lucky survivors streaming into the countryside. They'd gone begging to serve on the estates of the chieftains. No counter-revolution was organizing in the hills, living on hardtack and plotting to regain power with a really, really scathingly brilliant poem. The thugs and gangsters had the guns, so now they ruled their own nation of bondsmen and thralls. The bros and rednecks had the guns, so now they reigned over the serfs of Caucasia. The right-minded progressive gun-grabbers with their right side of history, they had their civil rights lawyers and Ninth Circuit Court. They lived their entire lives on paper. If they survived, it was as grateful slaves. The PhD gal stirred in her sleep. Dawson tried to recall her name from the list. Her bounty was 1,600 votes and could be auctioned for good money. Her name escaped him. It had been something made up. She blinked away. He didn't break eye contact until she looked away. He didn't need to. The roads were empty. He could feed her, get her some milk, a big glass of buttermilk. The wedding ring deep in his pants pocket told them this wouldn't be so easy. She slumped low, hiding low, and asked, "Where are you taking me?" "Canada," Dawson lied. On the horizon hovered a large white sign. Mounted atop a pole, it turned slowly. In large black letters against a white background, it read, "Whites Only." Dawson asked, "How does some breakfast sound?" She dashed tears from her eyes. "I need to feel safe somewhere." Dawson knew she'd never feel safe again. It was just as well this calamity had befallen her, he figured. She'd risen to power by repeating the opinions of people who'd repeated the opinions of people who'd repeated the opinions of people. If that wasn't a lineage equal to and just as corrupt as the lineages of Adjustment Day, Dawson didn't know Jack. History had saved this woman. She'd been given a chance, like Scarlett O'Hara, to be tested and develop a real power of her own making. The crying had cleaned her face some. Minus the crud, she wasn't so hard on the eyes. She looked at the plowed landscape with the dazed expression of a sleepwalker who'd woken up from a long dream about universal equality and guaranteed human rights. Dawson remembered. Her name was Ramantha. He parked in the gravel lot beside the diner, and they walked in and sat at a red-topped table. Flounced gingham curtains hung in the windows. They matched the frilled apron of the waitress who asked, "What can I get you folks?" Her breath, sweet-smelling from juicy fruit chewing gum. Dawson asked, "What's good?" A jukebox played country music at low volume. The waitress twiddled her pen between the fingers of one hand. "The Connor Bull white bean burrito is nice." She glanced back at the kitchen pass-through window. "And the Ava Braun white cheddar mac and cheese is real good." Ramantha held her menu too high. She was clearly hiding behind it. Muffled, she said, "I'll have the clan burger." The waitress eyed her. She popped her gum and asked, "Grand Dragon or Grand Wizard?" Dawson translated, "She means large or small." The waitress asked, "Honey, may I see some identification?" "What?" Ramantha looked out from behind the menu. "I'm 35. Dawson said, "I'll vouch for her." It wasn't proof of age the waitress wanted. It was proof of ethnicity. As a chieftain of the first lineage, he knew no one would doubt his word. He ordered a cup of coffee. The professor ordered a skinhead skinless chicken breast sandwich and a Woodrow Wilson egg salad sandwich and a Lothrop Stoddard vanilla sundae with marshmallow sauce and whipped cream. He sipped his coffee and watched her dig into the mountain of food. If she stunk, he'd grown used to her stink. By the look of her stringy arms, she couldn't fight off much. He could ravish her just for the effort of pushing her to the ground. The wedding ring felt big in his pocket. Dawson flagged the waitress and asked for the check, all the while telling himself that as soon as the sun set, he wasn't going to rape this half-dead woman. Nope. Positively not. No way was he raping her and strangling her skinny neck and cutting off her ear to sell, so he could buy his old lady that treadle sewing machine she'd been mooning after for better than a year. Theirs was the grandest wedding the fledgling nation of Caucasia had ever witnessed. After the regal promenade of the royal families, each chieftain bedecked in jewels and artificial furs, leading a contingent of pregnant wives. After the lavish banquet of the lineages. After the courtiers had toasted each other with chalices of healthy urine. After each public wife of the realm had bestowed her best wishes upon Queen Shasta, as she and Charlie stood on the parapets and waved to their thousands of serfs, It was then a tight formation of jumbo jetliners passed directly overhead. His eyes following them, Charlie did say, "There, the last of the Jews are homebound for Israel. A good omen. Let us celebrate." For their nuptial tour around the estate, an open carriage wrought from solid silver, a great heavy thing was pulled by a visibly straining, enormous herd of tiny white lambs. Whole mutton turned slowly on spits above raging bonfires, the air redolent with meaty smells and the stink of gunpowder, the latter from the celebratory fireworks. Mead did flow, and bodices were roundly ripped to the sound of merry pipers. In their first wedded moment alone, Charlie did take his new wife boldly in his arms. In noble modesty he acceded to Shasta that his was a simple, hard-laboring, tax-paying Caucasian penis without the dimensions or the stamina accredited to the black or the homosexual. His might not bring her the fulfillment of others, but he would strive to sow a multitude of seeds in her. Charlie would sow her and keep sowing her relentlessly, for she would be his mate. He'd sow her any time he desired, day or night, headache or none, and he'd sow her in any position he could imagine, and sow her wearing costumes, and as he compelled her to pretend to be his second-grade teacher, Mrs. Halliday, or a sexy airline stewardess, maybe. Or he'd sew her all tied up because the overarching edict of Caucasia was progress can wait. And in line with the teachings of Talbot, millions of men had died to create and protect the formerly United States. Those men had given their lives and perished in unspeakable agony. So now women should dedicate themselves to preserving the nation, and instead of landmines blasting them into screaming gore or mustard gas reaming out their lungs, this generation of women would be revered by a new nation of offspring and future generations for perpetuating the white race. Shasta, Charlie extolled, held the destiny of Caucasia between her legs. Still attired in her wedding finery, Shasta did demurely excuse herself to make water. Charlie gave her a peck on the cheek and told her not to tarry. They had yet to cut their towering wedding cake, nor had they danced to the traditional madrigals. Veiled did Shasta implement the next phase of her plan. The ruse with charm spit had worked. As their newly crowned queen, the palace guard could deny Shasta access to no area. Quickly she scurried to Charlie's home office. There she booted his antique computer machine. His was no great intellect, and she readily circumnavigated his crude security codes. His password was a bit cryptic. Mom and Dad, R.I.P. The device buzzed and blinked. Its screen began to scroll the names of the living and the targeted. Those who had been relocated to other homelands. Those who remained in Caucasia and to whom they were presently indentured. Among these names she found not that of her true love. For Shasta did love only one man. And contrary to appearances, it was not Charlie. And as the fireworks began to boom against the dusking sky, did she activate the search function and type in the name Walter Baines? Back in the world you still know, in the before times, Walter whispered to Talbot while the old man slept. He held up telephone photos of Shasta. He whispered about her wisdom and talents, about her beauty and strength and grace. And as the old man dozed and drowsed and snored, Walter held the pink foam earplug so Talbot couldn't help but catch a whiff of its acrid perfume. Jamal couldn't help but show off. Days and evenings he'd sit with the creature in the bygone glory of the parlor. The creature bragged up the men in the ancestral portraits, boasting about their acts of bravery and scientific achievements. Left unsaid was the constant drumbeat declaring the past to be a golden era and the present a swamp of failure. To remedy the situation, Jamal summoned the housekeeper and asked her to dress Barnabas for a day's outing. Nothing stressful. not much more than a jaunt to a nearby city to survey the changes that had taken place since the founding of Blacktopia. Arabella pulled a face. "You do realize," she said, "that soul hasn't set foot off this farm in years." Jamal assured her, "All's the more reason." Barnabas didn't appear partial to the idea either. It couldn't set foot over the threshold without wanting to go back for a different shirt or to change its shoes. Jamal's first point of pride was the levitator. The same electro-spiritual principles that floated the great space pyramids. This same black-based technology allowed personal transport vehicles that amounted to small floating platforms that could skim along at incredible speeds. Throughout history, white men had claimed that magic carpets were a fiction, simply because no white man could duplicate the achievement. Vehemently, whites had long sought to humiliate blacks by claiming the latter had never invented the wheel. The Barnabas creature tentatively climbed aboard the floating platform, as Jamal explained. Blacks in Africa had no use for wheels because they flew. They'd no use for any written language because they combined their wisdom, utilizing the technique of cognitive amalgamation. All of this wisdom had been secretly locked away when Europeans had begun to invade the continent. Barnabas gripped the front edge of the platform with metaphorically white knuckles. The rush of air rustled its mass of frizzed hair. The vehicle began its rise above the trees, above the house and barns. "Lordy, Master Jamal," the creature bawled. "God ain't never intentioned us to fly." As they soared above the open country, Jamal lectured on the state of things since Adjustment Day. Gaze, who'd lived such gadabout and footloose lives, in Gaysia, they were yoked to the National Campaign for Reproduction. Draconian sperm drives left most men with little money or energy. And women had lost all control over their reproductive rights. Healthy women were required to register and eventually to be conscripted to bear, not arms, but babies. To sustain their population via export left them with scant time for sadomasochistic antics or meth-fueled circuit parties. Jamal shouted to be heard above the wind. "Liberation has enslaved them." Citizens of Caucasia were no better off. Where they'd excelled in science, they now banned it. They'd turned their focus to Jeffersonian agriculture and reinstating a white European culture. The great metropolises of Caucasia had swiftly declined into deadly no-go zones where displaced liberal arts majors stalked each other as food. The lucky had escaped to indenture themselves to chieftains and labor on the huge food-producing estates. Below the levitator, the lands of Blacktopia appeared without houses or fences. All roadways, power poles, and other signs of human civilization had been erased. In their place, wild animals roamed. Sleek herds of zebras, horned masses of wildebeests. Jamal tried to read Barnabas's expression. The Peabody plantation stood alone, the last survivor of the many dynastic seats that had until recently filled the region. The creature could only stare, its mouth agog. Like a mirage, the rainbow-colored lights, the spires and domes of a city appeared in the distance. Unlike Caucasia, the populations of Blacktopia had coalesced into its cities, transforming them into magnificence, while allowing the greater landscape to revert back to an almost limitless nature preserve. The fauna of Mother Africa had been introduced and had flourished. The levitator carried them above the heads of wallowing hippos and preening lions. They dipped to better observe fierce packs of hyenas. A paradise it amounted to, and Jamal felt justified in his pride. Every wonder the white man had dismissed as a fable, here it existed. The city they approached rivaled all the legends about Atlantis. Blacks had resurrected all the pyro-spiritual and electro-expressive technologies they'd long kept hidden. These, The sacred laws of soul metrics had never been appropriated to enrich the white man's brutal empire. As a chieftain of the first lineage, Jamal would be warmly welcomed into any home. The levitator swerved and looped between the dramatic, multicolored skyscrapers. Flowering vines cascaded down from windows and balconies like brilliant flags. The Barnabas creature craned its neck as if searching for any vestige of the previous corrupt civilization built by white people. Mere months had elapsed since Adjustment Day.
"Master Jamal," it stammered. "How?"
"Musometrics," Jamal answered. He explained that the harmonic gifts of his race had much deeper applications than the white man had ever suspected. When a sufficient population of blacks harmonized in unison, the power of their combined song would restructure physical matter. Each massive building amounted to the frozen music of a single beautiful song. Indeed, every pinnacle soared like a crescendo. Jamal steered the levitator toward a prominent edifice. Domed and buttressed, it dwarfed the less imposing structure surrounding it. At the gateway, a liveried robot assisted him and Barnabas to disembark. They entered through dazzling crystalline doors and crossed a plush lobby alive with blooming tropical plants and free-flying parrots and cockatiels. Barnabas cowed, whispered,
"Lordy, massa, who live here?"
The whispers echoed back from the vaulted ceiling and the chamber's trove of priceless antiquities. Jamal didn't shush the creature. He took pity on the stooped freak that was shrinking itself ever smaller in fear. Barnabas was beyond the age of finding out. It was full of shit. Past the lobby, none but a single pair of doors, heavily sculpted from what appeared to be solid gold, so warm and so bright. Only these doors stood. Jamal touched a discreet button and chimes sounded. The doors swung inward to reveal a robot attired in a tuxedo. In a warm, cultured voice, this robot bid,
"Greetings, Jamal. Is your mother expecting you?"
The robot ushered them into a luminous chamber. It held the muffled silence of a greenhouse. Orchids were rooted in the intricately tiled walls, and their trembling blossoms scented the air with sweetness. Following the robot's gesture, Jamal and the Barnabas creature seated themselves on expensive wicker settees. They accepted tall, highly colored drinks offered by a robot dressed in a lacy apron and cap. Hardly were they settled before another door opened, and a rush of colors and perfumes swept into their presence. A swirl of iridescent silk skirt revealed two perfectly sculpted gams striding toward them. Braided hair glinted with Tahitian pearls and platinum beads.
"My darling," said the dulcet voice of a goddess.
Slender and regal, she crossed to kiss Jamal lightly on both cheeks. Her eyes fell on the creature, and her refined features twisted. At the sight of this stained dwarf, her smooth face shriveled with confusion and fear. Jamal and the Barnabas creature stood to greet her. Not a heartbeat passed before she regained her queenly composure.
"Hello."
She offered a languid hand, the fingers weighted with diamond rings, the wrist loaded with emerald bracelets.
"I am Jamal's mother."
Her expression betrayed none of her earlier alarm. Jamal had always admired his mom. Rich or poor, she'd always been a class act. And as she accepted the withered, discolored paw of the creature, his respect grew beyond all bounds. She threw him a look of concern, masked behind a serene smile, marked only because her eye contact lasted a smidgen too long. Her silent nod summoned a robot bearing a silver tray of amuse-bouche.
"I hope you like nightingale tongues," she said.
Added the robot in a scratchy, affectless voice.
"They're bite-sized."
Jamal watched with mild delight as the creature picked from among the delicacies.
"I's be Barnabas," it said, and popped a tidbit into its grinning mouth. His mother maintained her composure as the creature regaled them with tales about farm life.
"That Miss Joe, she bees a monster to works for,"
it said through a mouthful of partially masticated tongues. It went on to describe menial chores and how Miss Josephine had fled immediately following Adjustment Day.
"That Master Talbot, he bees a true hero."
Jamal's mother took this in stride. "My son has long been obsessed with living in that particular house." The Barnabas creature cast him a puzzled look. Jamal gave his mother a sideways glance, one eyebrow raised to warn her. "Yes," he added. "We have family history in the area." The creature did a goggle-eyed double take.
"Was y'all family slavers?"
Jamal's mother motioned for a robot to refresh their drinks. "Something like that," she sighed. They passed a pleasant afternoon. Jamal's mother shepherded them into her kitchen, where the flesh generator provided a delicious luncheon. She explained proudly how the technology was based on HeLa cells, immortal cells that continue to reproduce themselves indefinitely. These cells had been invented by a black woman and used to alter the DNA of animals, creating masses of beef, chicken, and pork that spontaneously cloned themselves. The flesh generator itself was a huge cylinder of meat that turned slowly under heat lamps. The exterior was always a savory cooked layer ready to be carved away and eaten. At the core were the ever-replicating cells, fed by a constant stream of amino acids pumped through the spindle at the core of the cylinder. To Jamal, it looked like nothing more than an old-school gyro cone, grilling on a vertical rotisserie. But in this case, the tapering amalgam of boneless flesh was a living thing, raw and vital at the core, but constantly dying and being cooked on the outside. The scent was intoxicating. They watched the meat rotate smoothly. It sweated clear grease that ran in rivulets down its appetizing flanks.
"The true blessing is that we no longer need to slaughter animals," said Jamal's mother.
The core's genetically immortal cells were like a sourdough starter that perpetuated itself given the right conditions. Every household included such a generator. Thus, the animals of Blacktopia caroused in complete safety and freedom. Even the carnivores were fed from similar flesh generators. Fully satiated on immortal meat, the lions did in fact lie down with the lambs. Black technology had created heaven on earth. Barnabas recoiled at first, but a single mouth-watering bite made it a convert. Jamal's mother leaned close to the creature as if sharing an intimate confidence.
"I do hope you can convince my son to demolish that old farm and assume his place of prestige here in the city."
She looked pointedly at Jamal. Her tone was prickly.
"His obsession with that ancient homestead is entirely unhealthy."
He and his mother had debated this point many times. Instead of engaging on the topic, Jamal noted the time and insisted on taking Barnabas home. The creature fell silent on their trip back home. The sight of so many wonders had clearly shaken Barnabas. It glanced about with bulging, confused eyes. Jamal felt a huge sympathy, almost a familial affection for it. A heavy inky tear washed a lighter stripe down its cheek. It spoke haltingly.
"I assume y'all wants to eradicate Miss Joe's family place?"
Jamal fixed the creature with a compassionate expression.
"I promise," he vowed, "that as long as you live, that house will stand as your home."
The Barnabas creature gazed into the distance. There, the familiar barns and manor house were slowly coming into sight. In the backdrop, the sun was setting rapidly.
Bing held the bong to his mouth, sighting down the length of it as if it were a rifle. He held a cigarette lighter to the packed bowl and flicked the lighter as if he were pulling a trigger. He inhaled so hard he went cross-eyed. With his lungs full, he shouted, "Bang, bang, bang," expelling dope smoke like bursts of gun smoke. He jerked the bong from side to side as if firing on new targets, the peppermint schnapps inside it sloshing. He sighted a final target through the bong and puffed out a muffled bang. Felix clutched his heart in both hands and fell backward against a garbage can. "You got me," he croaked. "I'm dead." Bing handed the lighter to Felix. He lowered the bong and turned his attention to reloading the bowl. "Alive defines dead," he sighed. "You never feel as alive as when you make somebody else dead." He described how it had felt to be in the shooting gallery of the legislature, Bing's favorite topic. They sat, just the two of them, in the alley back of Felix's apartment house. Delicious was out. Felix's mom was home, which was why he was hiding outdoors pulling bong hits. Being alone with his mom was agony these days. She was forever guilt-tripping him to not declare his preference, to wait at least a year to stay at home and keep her company. But when he considered another year in Geisha, another hands-off year watching everyone else find love while every pussy was off-limits to him, the wait made him crazy. Bing handed him the bong, saying, "I can't believe you're not homo." It was okay for Bing to know. Bing was a national hero, a chieftain of the first lineage. He'd stood in the spectators' gallery and put a stop to the old order, where weaklings had pandered and lied to win the popularity contest people used to call politics. For Bing, nothing would ever compare to Adjustment Day. That was why he'd become a stoner, because he'd never matched the rush of blowing away the framework of his oppression. Felix took the bong, seeing the inside of Bing's forearm, the tattoo there below the rolled-up sleeve of his shirt. Felix asked, "Is that Andy Warhol?" Bing twisted his arm to read his own tattoo. "It's Talbot," he asked. "Did I tell you I met him?" Felix had the bong around his lips as he said, "Only a million times." His words sounded muffled inside the tube of it. The tattoo read, "In the future, everyone will be shot for 15 minutes." "Yeah," Bing said. "I was there when he said it." He told the story so many times, about Talbot being lashed to a chair with leather belts and duct tape, naked and bloodied, but still issuing orders, about the chieftains each seeking an audience with him in the weeks leading up to Adjustment Day. Felix exhaled, asking, "How did it feel?" And he inhaled through the bong. The schnapps bubbled, and the mint-tasting smoke flooded his mouth. They both knew what he meant, and it felt wonderful. Killing your enemy felt better than the biggest lottery win. It felt like having the last word, the ultimate victory. As it was written in the Talbot book, the core human drive is to dominate and to avoid being dominated. And, as the book was quick to add, anyone who denies that fact is simply trying to dominate you. Felix held the smoke in his chest and listened. "So, where you headed?" asked Bing. He meant Caucasia or Blacktopia. It was a testament to Geisha that Bing could sit here taking deep bong hits in a cat piss smelling alley at midnight. In Caucasia and Blacktopia, citizens with a preponderance of Asian genetics were deported to Asia, Jews to Israel, Mexican types self-exiled to Mexico. And for the first time, an idea dawned on Felix. He'd never seen Bing with another man. Maybe Bing was a heterosexual hiding out like his own parents. Maybe the reason Bing was always baked was because he didn't want to be shipped off to another continent, yet he wasn't a homosexual either. Bing might be someone he could trust with all of his secrets. Felix held his breath and shrugged. He'd crossed the genetic testing bridge when he came to it. He still had to fill out the paperwork for his formal declaration of preference. "Killing is killing," said Bing. It was the best rush, bar none. It was like winning the biggest win, to see your enemies burst open, to hear them fall silent, and to know they'd never again hurt you. It was the end of your worst fears, the confirmation that you don't need to be anyone's slave. Bing had told the story so many times, in bars, in front of school assemblies, he amounted to a living fossil. A stoned living fossil. The thought almost made Felix laugh. Because a fossil was by definition encased in stone, and Bing's eyes were so fucking bloodshot, even as he recounted forcing some terrified senator to fill the burial pits at gunpoint. "To remove the person from a person," Bing insisted. "To reduce somebody to nothing but meat and hair, it's like a magic trick only real, you know?" He coughed, choking out the word. "Isn't that what a miracle is?" Felix nodded vehemently and handed back the bong. He debated telling Bing the whole truth. A little stoned, he trusted that Bing would understand. Bing had kept his secret about being heterosexual since Felix had moved in next door to them. "Promise me something," Felix asked. "Will you check in on my mom? Like, on Christmas? Just so she's not totally alone." Packing the bowl, Bing dismissed this concern. "Your mom has Delicious. Delicious is going to have a kid." Felix waited until the bong was reloaded and his friend was sparking the bowl. As Bing sucked down a toke, Felix marveled. The setup was perfect. And it wasn't just the weed talking. Bing was obviously a fugitive too, living next door. Felix could make his declaration and find his own future knowing that Bing would stay around. Granted, Felix's dad would be here, but he couldn't risk crossing paths with his secret wife. That, and Delicious was here, but she was practically a stranger. Bing, his best friend, would continue to watch over Felix's mother while she grew old. The bowl full of dope flared bright orange in the dark. The schnapps gurgled. "Don't take this the wrong way," Felix began. He looked for light in any nearby windows. The only glowing window was high up in his apartment, where his mom would be sitting alone in the kitchen. He asked, "We're friends, right?" Bing's chest swelled with the smoke. His red eyes met Felix's, and he nodded. Felix continued, "I know why you're here in Geisha." Bing cocked his head, still holding the smoke. "You're like my parents," Felix explained. "My dad is black. They both moved here, claiming to be homosexual, but they're secretly married and get together on the sly." The smoke exploded from Bing's mouth in a huge, "What?" Felix had fucked up. The bong set carefully aside. Bing glowered. "Say what?" Loud. A window appeared, as inside a light flashed on. Another window appeared. Felix held up both hands to shush his friend. "Nothing. A joke." "So, does Delicious know?" asked Bing. His eyes blinked. "Or is Delicious a heterosexual too?"
For the first time, Felix could see the old being. The man his friend had been, who could shoulder a rifle and mow down everyone he considered an enemy. Above them, other lights outlined new windows. People would hear. One window scraped open, and a voice called down, "It's late!" Felix lunged. He clamped a hand over Bing's mouth and held it, whispering, "Please, don't." The two grappled, tumbling sideways on the littered ground, wrestling in the cigarette butts and bottle caps. Bing's fingernails clawed at Felix's hand, clawed at his face and neck, but Felix held on, whispering, "You can't!" As their legs kicked over garbage cans and people shouted down at them in the dark, Bing clobbered Felix with a fist to the head. Bing bashed him between the eyes, and Felix felt heat spray from his nose, and he tasted salt and peppermint schnapps, and he felt Bing's screams muffled against his palm. Both of Bing's hands were pounding him in the ribs. His knees pummeled Felix's gut. More windows were bright, and far overhead stood the outline of Felix's mom, the upper half of her head and shoulders outlined in the light from her kitchen. Bing's teeth sank into his palm, and Felix snatched his hand back. Bing's voice rang out, "Heterosexuals! Heterosexuals!" And Felix's bleeding fingers found the long tube of the bong and grabbed it up and brought it down. The glass broke across something, and Bing fell silent. Blood and peppermint schnapps splashed everywhere. Bing's body went limp and toppled backward onto the pavement. Any person was gone from the person, reduced to nothing but meat and hair. The night air carried the growing sound of police sirens. Felix had heard the stories enough to know. His only friend was dead. Worse than dead, Bing was wrong. Killing him hadn't made Felix feel even the least bit great. When Nick found the first box, he wasn't surprised. It sat in the middle of Southeast Yamhill Street, between 42nd and 43rd. The Talbot book predicted as much. The book had gotten everything right so far. The fires had started weeks before, just as the Talbot book had foreseen. Here was the same method the elites had used in the 1965 Watts fire that had destroyed 100 square blocks, in the 1967 Newark fires, and the 1967 Detroit fire that had wiped out 400 buildings. As in Washington, D.C. in 1968, with 1,199 buildings burned, it was always the whites torching black neighborhoods. To herd black citizens away from urban areas and back to lives as sharecroppers and field hands in the Deep South. These days, it was the Caucasian chieftains committing arson in order to drive any lingering blacks to Blacktopia and to drive the remaining Portland whites out to the estates. The box left on the street was the same deal. In the 1950s, such a box would be filled with heroin. In the 1990s, it would be crack cocaine. Whatever the decade, the CIA would leave the box in any neighborhood they wanted to destroy. Now it was the chieftains. Nick tore the cardboard open and sorted the bags packed inside. He shoved the pockets of his trench coat full of Vicodin and Ambien and Xanax, pounds of them sealed in plastic. The rest he left. According to the Talbot book, they'd drop a mess of these boxes, and Nick scuttled off to high-grade the rest. A poster on a nearby wall screamed out, "A smile is your best bulletproof vest." Nick's only family, his mom, had packed up and gambled her last tank of gas on finding an estate where she could pledge herself. Word was, the big land operations were fringed with favelas of displaced media and information workers, all living out of their dusty cars, washed-up web designers and diversity officers.
They were all hoping to prove themselves in the upcoming rhubarb harvest and to be awarded a thatched cottage before winter set in. The entire wiki squat of the internet was trashed. The only radio was Talbot and approved Caucasian music, mostly polkas, with some waltzes and jigs. The greatest hits of harpsichord and bagpipe. The radio announced that the fires had been set by loyalists, partisans. Talbot himself denounced any rumors that the old president had escaped and that a lookalike had been assassinated in his stead. Officially, the president of the formerly United States was dead. Officially, the fires that sprang up at night and drove helpless people into the dark streets were set by rebels. Bandits or highwaymen. Maybe Canadians. Canadians, Nick noted, were branded the new terrorists. According to Talbot's book, throughout modern history, well-meaning blacks had been persecuted. Each time a city had burst into flame, when black citizens had rushed to save property threatened by the fire, white military forces had used this as a pretense to arrest them for looting. These days, as fires churned through block after block of Portland, anyone who tried to help was arrested. Convicted of trumped-up charges, they were railroaded to work gangs. The boxes. The boxes allowed the less heroic another option. As Talbot phrased it, less useful members of society could self-select to leave through accidental overdose or suicide. The fires foiled the heroes. The drugs resolved the cowards. Only Nick could eke out a life staying buzzed when there was no food to be found. Sleep was a different matter. The great chieftain estates with their fabled swaths of runner beans and red cabbages, they'd displace the wild packs of wolves and coyotes. Those animals, as well as bears and cougars, had roamed into the city streets, the parks and neighborhoods seeking new prey. Nights, when they howled and their victims screamed, Nick had the pills to sleep soundly in whatever abandoned automobile. Days, he'd come across a mess that might stretch for city blocks. The rib cage and spine in one place, the head and pelvis would be dragged off. The skull might be gone, but there was always the matted hair. Usually the hands, too. The sidewalk or alley would be sticky with dried blood, with footprints of blood wandering off in every direction. The footprints of wolves or bear. The scavenger prints of coyotes and raccoons, magpies, rats. Each trail of red prints pointed the direction of some missing arm or entrails. Some hapless so-and-so. The fingers of the gnawed-on hands would be loaded with diamond rings, ruby rings. The eyes would be pecked out, but a pearl necklace would be left behind, mired in the blood. Carnivores knew what was actually of real value. The Xanax took care of the absolute worst aspect of modern city life. Not the food insecurity or the dying nighttime screams. The toughest detail to deal with was the loneliness. Shasta was gone, as were Walter and Xavier. No one except the certifiable had stayed in the inner city, and Nick steered a wide course around them. A block distant, an excellent example lurked. A naked old man, his wrists and ankles flapping with scraps of dirty duct tape. His emaciated body looked glossy with dried blood. What might be a hash-marked carpet of tiny stab wounds dotted his spindly arms and legs. The man ambled along the deserted sidewalk. He caught sight of Nick and waved. The butchered apparition craned its thin neck and shouted, "Walter!" In a different direction, it shouted again, "Walter!" Nick turned tail and did not wave back. According to Talbot, the Civil War had nothing to do with slavery. In reality, the famous war between the states had been just a ruse to cull the vast numbers of Irish who were emigrating to northern cities. Another youth bulge
neutralized. He found another box on Southeast Woodstock and filched the pills. Outside a burned house in the Westmoreland neighborhood, he found a pile of scorched furniture. Armloads of clothes still on hangers. Ralph Lauren, Gucci, Armani. These clothes were illegal to wear now. He picked through the pile and found a gun, but no bullets. A perfectly good guitar. The worst aspect of loneliness was the silence. Birdsong was the only regular sound, besides the wind. He swung the pack off his back and dug out a bag of pills. He placed two Xanax in his mouth and tasted the sweetness as they dissolved under his tongue. On Northeast Mississippi Avenue, he found a third box and tore into its contents. Talbot had spoken slowly while Walter and the assembled men had leaned forward to listen.
The burial pits should measure 300 feet long by 30 feet wide and 12 feet deep.
All the while strapped to the same chair, he'd instructed.
The floor of each pit must be sealed with a layer of quarter-inch thick polyethylene sheeting, topped by a 2-foot-thick layer of impervious clay. To save effort, he encouraged consistency, saying, "Don't everyone try to reinvent the wheel."
In recent days, the basement had become a clubhouse of sorts, a headquarters or command center. Naylor and Esteban, the men from the narcotics recovery group, had come knocking. On their heels had appeared other men, all of them apparently recruited from similar groups across the country. If Walter had to guess, they were heterosexuals and homosexuals, black and white. They'd all joined Talbot's new payroll and zealously followed the ever-growing internet list of names now dubbed America's Least Wanted. And as Walter had been dispatched to compile his notes and hire a printer, these men came to serve as Talbot's inner circle. Each man had overcome his own demon, be it heroin or cancer, and now he was here to conquer something bigger. As they'd crowded around Talbot's knee, he told them,
"Flattery is addictive. Convince others they're special. Assure them they have talent. Make yourself the source of people's self-worth. Doing so binds them to you, and it preempts them from developing their skills and proving their true potential."
As they'd passed cans of beer and bags of chips, he told them,
"Assembly is expression. Individuals must be granted the right to associate with those and only those they select. The groups that result shall not be compelled to open their ranks to those they wish to exclude."
Delirious from so many tiny infections, Talbot had ranted,
"Be horrible. Exist as a horrible threat, and at the moment of your greatest power, stay your hand. By hurting people and then not hurting them, you acquire their love."
He told them,
"Imagine there's no God. There is no heaven or hell. There is only your son, and his son, and his son, and the world you leave for them."
If they'd laughed, if they sparked to an idea, nodding their heads in agreement, Talbot had snapped.